Coming up.
I think, Sebastian. Therefore, I am.
What goes on?
How do I know you're a fellow human being with a rich inner life like me?
I know I have a mind because I have direct access to it. But how do I know that you've got a mind?
Are you coming in?
No, no. I want to be alone with my thought.
What goes on in your heart? What goes on in your mind?
How do I know if anybody else really exists?
Are you alone?
Yes.
No. We are here with you.
Our guest is Anita Avramides, author of Other Minds.
What goes on in your mind?
Am I alone?
Coming up on Philosophy Talk. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the studios of KAOW San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that began at Philosopher's Corner at Stanford, where Ken and I teach philosophy.
Today, we're asking, am I alone? The problem of other minds.
Well, Ken, I know that I have a mind. I know what feelings, sensations, and thoughts I'm having. And I seem to know this in a very direct way. I don't have to make any inferences or guesses. I don't have to listen carefully to what I say to figure out what I think. But what about other people? Like you, for example. Can I really be sure that you have a mind like I do?
Come on, John. The way you looked at me, I could ask you the same thing, dude. I'm certainly not directly aware of those supposed thoughts and sensations and feelings of yours. So can I really know that you have a mind?
Well, at this point, I can imagine a listener thinking, oh my gosh, there go those philosophers again. What sane, rational person goes around doubting whether other people really have minds?
Well, that's why we're called philosophers. You know, look, you and I know that the philosophical problem of other minds isn't really a practical, everyday problem. You know, if you look at it, people are actually pretty good at figuring out what other people are thinking and feeling. Cognitive science actually teaches us that our capacity for mind reading, as they like to call it, may actually be hardwired into our brains.
Well, if cognitive science knows so much about it, what's left over for us poor philosophers to worry about?
Well, because we're trying to figure out something different. We're trying to understand the rational basis for our belief in other minds. I mean, we know that we do, in fact, believe in other minds. Not many people doubt that. But are we really justified in so believing? Does that belief even deserve to be called knowledge, John?
As opposed to what?
Well, as opposed to just a gut instinct, an instinctual hunch with no real basis in either reason or evidence or argument. That's what.
Well, a lot of our beliefs are just, you know, instinctual hunches without much basis. But it would be nice if our belief in other minds, which is pretty central to our picture of the world, rested on something a little bit better than an instinct or a habit.
Well, so here's an argument for you that it does, John, and I think you'll like this argument. Okay, it's called the argument from analogy. You're a human being, just like me. You behave in a lot like me, well, most of the time anyway. You use language in much the way I do. Well, I have a mind. So isn't it rational to suppose by analogy that you have a mind too? There you go.
No, it's a terrible argument. I mean, consider the sample size. There's 6 billion people in the world. You looking at one of them and said, oh, wow. This one has a mind, so everybody else does too. Imagine there's 200 cars on the freeway. They're all very similar. They all have four wheels. They all move in response to the way the drivers steer and the way the drivers accelerate, the way they brake. We notice that one of these cars has a box of Kleenex on the front seat, maybe our own. And so we infer all the others do too. That's absurd. Your argument about the 6 billion humans all having minds because you do is a million times more absurd.
Well, okay, let's try it another way, John. Suppose we look under the hood of the car and we find an engine inside and we think and investigate and we figure out that the engine explains why the car moves the way it does. Now, come on. Would you deny that it's a good inference that other cars probably have engines, too, and the engines probably explain the way they work, too? You wouldn't deny that, would you?
No, that's better. But now you're making what philosophers call an inference to the best explanation. All the cars move in certain ways. We figure out the right explanation, even if it's just for one of them. That's a big step. The right explanation is has an engine. So other things being equal, that's the best explanation for the others.
So the same thing with minds. We know that other people have minds not on the basis of that risky analogical reasoning you were so dismissive of, but on something tried and true from the sciences, inference to the best explanation. We use it all the time.
Well, I've still got my doubts. Does inference to the best explanation really explain the degree of certainty that I hope you feel about my mind?
Well, why wouldn't it?
Well, because there's lots of different ways that minds might work. Take cars. In fact, nowadays, they don't all work the same. Some have electric motors rather than gasoline engines. Your mind and my mind could be as different as cars with different sorts of engines. Maybe I have a big, powerful V8 and you have a little hybrid.
Yeah, I get you. I can introspectively look under the hood of my own mind, as it were. But what then makes me so confident that your mind works the very same way that mine does?
Well, and to push it further, are you really so sure you even know very much about your own mind?
Oh, gosh, now that, you know, we question everything. And that's an assumption, the assumption that we know our own minds in a way that we can't know other minds. I guess that one does need to be questioned, too.
So we got a lot to think about, Ken.
Yeah, and to give us even more to chew on, we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Natalie Jones, to talk to people who study the minds of children and the other minds they create. She files this report.
Before we're old enough to wonder whether everything around us is real, we first have to learn that everything around us is not us, that other people have their own thoughts. It seems kids understand relatively early that others exist. But then what does it mean when kids create worlds or people that don't actually exist? Imaginary friends.
Millie the Mermaid, she is
your best friend.
Yeah, and she loves to play with me, and she loves Chubby the Bear. And her tail is blue because she's a mermaid. And she also likes Vikings.
Children start to pretend around the same time they start to talk. Why would they do that? They have so much to learn about the real world. But right away, they're thinking about things that don't exist.
Psychology professor Marjorie Taylor at the University of Oregon has spent the last 20 years or so trying to figure it out.
At the time when I first started doing work in this area, there was a negative stereotype of children who had imaginary friends, the idea that they were sort of solitary children, maybe a little confused about fantasy and reality, maybe lacking real friends, that sort of thing.
And sometimes when I play with it, I pretend it comes to life.
But Taylor's research doesn't support that stereotype. She finds the kids with imaginary friends aren't shy and have a solid understanding of reality and fantasy. Not only that, but in some areas they actually do better than kids without imaginary friends.
They tend to be able to take the perspective of another person, a real person, better than other children.
It seems the time they spend in the imaginary mind of another impacts their understanding of real minds, and might just improve their relationship skills.
When they're talking about their real friends, they're more likely to mention mental states, like beliefs, desires, and thoughts, and that sort of thing. So you see that they're more attuned, they're more thinking about mental life than other kids.
She's been with me since I was born, and she always got my back when I felt sad.
It appears these children are actually more social, or at least more socially attuned than others. So, what about adults?
People say, oh yeah, when I was a child I had a good imagination, but now I don't. People say that a lot.
But Taylor says it's not that simple.
Imagination is not something that's just about children. It's a very fundamental part of who we are. So we're constantly thinking in our own minds about how things could have been, rethinking what's happened to us, planning for the future, living in fictional worlds through all the fantasy that in our everyday lives.
As far as we know, our lives are mostly real, but they're also always a little bit not real. Maybe it's not as easy to notice when the fantasies are about PowerPoint presentations rather than mermaids.
I tend to think of imagination as the capacity to mentally transcend your current time, place, and or circumstance. And that is something that we just do so routinely we don't even pay attention to it.
So the next time you catch yourself muttering out loud to no one, or see your child talking to an invisible friend in the corner, don't worry. Those habits actually help us make sense of what's in other people's heads, or at least what we think is in their heads.
And Millie the mermaid shall always be by your back.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Natalie Jones.